discuss Berlin and the impact that Berlin had on the Rav. We took for granted the Rav was in Berlin, and we never really analyzed, when we knew the Rav, all the experiences, all the people he met, and the impact it had. Coming back to the Avodat HaMelech and its relationship with the Rav, I had a beautiful experience this past week when I was speaking with the Rav's sister, Shulamit Meiselman, and the Rav, thank God, two sisters should live and be well. They're not youngsters, but the two sisters survived, and as I've said more than once, the Soloveitchik women aged a lot better than the Soloveitchik men. And Shulamit Meiselman, who spent the formative years in Warsaw, actually, when you speak with her, you feel that she's reliving, you feel Warsaw right in front of you. And she told me something fascinating, that the Rav's uncle, Rabbi Nachman Krakowski, who I explained to you last week, was married to the eldest Feinstein daughter, Badana. She was the eldest daughter of Rebellia Pluzhana and his wife. And Rabbi Nachman Krakowski went on to become one of the focal dayanim in Vilna. I don't go into great detail about Vilna. See, Vilna did not have a chief rabbi after the time of the Vilna Gaon. At the time of the Vilna Gaon, the chief rabbi was Reb Shmuel, and then following Reb Shmuel's death, there was a tremendous machloket who should be chief rabbi. This can be checked out in the books dealing with the Vilna community. But when we Jews fight, it becomes very nasty. In order to avoid any reoccurrence of such a fight in the future, so the Vilna community said they would never have a chief rabbi again, which they never had. I don't want to go into great detail now because I'm touching upon a very fascinating historic topic. What they had was a Beit Din, and they had three dayanim. And these dayanim all had separate responsibilities. Now, Reb Menachem Krakowski was the dayan in Magid Meshurim of Vilna. His job was one of the three dayanim, and he also was the public preacher on Aseres Yemei Teshuva, Shabbos HaGadol, public occasions, a big funeral. He was the one who was required by the community to speak. In parentheses, I can just tell you that what I said a minute ago may not be entirely true. What do I mean by that? Under the laws of independent Poland and independent Lithuania, and Vilna goes back and forth, and you can read all about this in Rakafar and Chelik Bet in the Hebrew section. Following World War I, you see, Reb Chaim Isaac Grzynski joins the Vilna based in his early 20s. Reb Chaim Isaac Grzynski was a towering figure, and he was looked upon as the premier Rav in Vilna. It's the Rav of Vilna. World War I, Reb Chaim Isaac Grzynski left the city at a certain point when the battlefield reached there. And in his absence, the local community started to demand, we must have a chief rabbi to meet government requirements. The government required a chief rabbi, a rabbi who would be in charge of divorce and marriage, because now you have a democratic country and or a republic, let's say, and the Jewish people have to live up to the laws like everybody else. Now, when you require a chief rabbi to register marriage and divorce, the law was he had to be a gymnasium graduate. In the absence of Reb Chaim Isaac Grzynski, they elected Rabbi Yitzchak Rubinstein chief rabbi. Rabbi Yitzchak Rubinstein was a Slabodka yeshiva student, had gone to gymnasium, had the necessary government requirements, he was a Talmud Chacham, but he had secular knowledge. However, in no way was he a Reb Chaim Isaac Grzynski. And when Reb Chaim Moshe returned, this led to a tremendous machloket in the Vilna community where the Chafetz Chaim got involved. There's a tremendous amount of literature. The Chafetz Chaim was reproached that all his life he ran away from machlokes and Lashon Hara. And how does he get involved in such a machlokes in Vilna? Reb Chaim Moshe said it's Kavarat Teira. It was a tremendous machloket. And there was tremendous friction and tension between the Zionist Mizrahi element of the community and the Agudah element of the community until World War II. Of course, here was Rabbi Isaac Rubinstein, who was the chief rabbi formally, and here was Reb Chaim Moshe, who was the chief rabbi, if not de facto, but de facto, if not de jure. And it was a source of tremendous heartache and controversy. What's fascinating from the YU point of view is that Rubinstein is pulled out at the last minute, and he goes via Rabbi Chaim Moshe, dies in 1940. Rabbi Rubinstein goes via Japan, winds up in America, 41 if I'm not mistaken, and he teaches at YU. YU takes him in. He's a Rosh Yeshiva. He's given an honorary doctorate in 44, I believe it is. He dies a year later. In 45, he passes on. So it's a fascinating point of history, but this was the Vilna Rabbinate, and Rabbi Nachman Karakupsky was a dayan there. Now, Shulamit said, whenever he came to Warsaw, Warsaw was a major city, and Vilna is now part of Poland, the interbellum period, this is before it goes back to Lithuania, it moves back and forth. Whenever he could, he came to Warsaw. The first thing he did, the minute he finished his official duties, he came into the home of his brother-in-law and sister-in-law, and Shulamit described that he walked into the house. The first thing he would say, Avu is Beryl. The family knew the Rav, Rav Yosef Tov, my Rebbe, they knew him as Beryl. The first thing the family would say, the first thing Rav Menachem Karakupsky would say, where is Beryl? And he would immediately, Beryl, begin talking and learning with him. And Shulamit described that he wouldn't even take off his coat. His coat was still on. Beryl walked into the aunt room and started walking up and down with his uncle. They started talking and learning, and this was the relationship between them. So this will explain to you why the uncle leaned on the Rav. When the Rav went to Berlin, he had Baruch Hashem Beryl to lean on to help him out with sources and Makorot and what is the correct reading in the Rambam. So it just adds a little bit flavor to the Avodat HaMelech, and is quoting Ben Gisi Hagon HaTzahir. He quotes him with beautiful language. It adds a little bit flavor to the relationship between Rabbi Nachman Krakupsky and Reb Yosef Tov, and I'm in debt to Shulamit Meisman. What I just told you now, there's only one person in the world who's yet alive who could reveal this, and that's Shulamit Meisman. Now, a few words on the Rav's dissertation. Rabbi Aaron Lichtenstein wrote, and this is how it became part of our knowledge, and again, I trust that Rabbi Aaron knew exactly what he was writing, that originally in Berlin, the Rav wanted to write his doctorate on Maimonides and Plato. I have it on page 27. He wanted to deal with Maimonides to show that he was not a confirmed Aristotelian, but this was never came to fruition because on the faculty there was no philosopher who was that learned in Maimonides who could oversee such a doctorate. Instead, the Rav wrote on Hermann Cohn. I'm very proud. That's my translation of Das Reine Denken und den Sein Konstruktoren by Hermann Cohn. It took me a long time to translate that into English. I worked with people who know German inside out. And when it was all said and done, some people who come from Germany told me that's a very good translation. Israel Hildesheimer later quoted my translation as something he wrote and said that was the best way to put it into English. Now, I've never seen the Rav's doctorate. I've seen a title page has circulated. I've never seen the Rav's doctorate. I'll say the following. Hermann Cohn, and I describe him here in a few words, was a top-grade German philosopher, Jewish individual. He was very big on Kant and took Kant much further on what is reality. Hermann Cohn's own life is fascinating, because towards the latter part of his life, he's invited to lecture in Warsaw as well. At there was a big Beit Midrash there for Chochmat Yisrael, Wissenschaft, and he's invited to lecture. And it seems that his coming into close contact with Polish Jews had a very cathartic effect upon him. And you can read about it in the Encyclopedia Judaica, and there's more written, you can follow the bibliography there. It seems that Hermann Cohn became a lot more observant in his own personal life, and the whole concept of religion and HaKadosh Baruch Hu became a lot more meaningful to him as a result with his meeting or his confluence with the Polish Jews, the Wissenschaft School in Warsaw. What's fascinating is that this Cantonian or Neo-Cantonian outlook had a great influence on the Rav. It's reflected in all his philosophic lectures, in a lot of his sermonics, a lot of his dashanut. And I can give it to you the simplest example. You all know that Kant introduced the concept of thesis, antithesis, synthesis. Time and again, the Rav comes back to it. When he speaks in terms of the community and the individual, your thesis is the individual is supreme, the individual has divine rights, the individual is Yitzhak Kapav Shal HaKadosh Baruch Hu. The antithesis is that an individual alone is powerless. He must be part of a community. We have a collective responsibility. Am Yisrael, Klal Yisrael. The synthesis, if there is any, is to find, to bridge the gap between the individual and the community. And this is a Jew. A Jew is constantly caught up with these tensions because we're individuals. On that level, our religious concepts are universal. The Catholic and the Protestant also deal with religion on an individual basis. However, on a communal basis, there we have an added identity which a Catholic and a Protestant doesn't have. And this is an ongoing tension. And the Rav, I remember one time the Rav gave a talk where he raised the issue of Robinson Crusoe. You know, I was overwhelmed. As I said yesterday, most of our Rabbeim were European, didn't know about life and about Western culture. The Rav raised Robinson Crusoe. Do you admire him? Do you look up to him? Is he a role model? Or is it the opposite? And there was the entire question of the individual versus the community. And the Rav developed the idea that as much as a role model as Robinson Crusoe was for his individuality and his ability to sustain his own life all by himself, nevertheless for a Jew, he's not a total role model because he lost the concept of community. When you don't have community, you can't do chesed. And you can't be part of the overall concept of B'nai Yisrael. And you see, there you see the thesis, the antithesis. Now, could there, and time and again, you will see this in all the Rav's learning, and all the Rav's dashanit, and all the Rav's homiletical thrust. He'll always create the thesis, the antithesis. Now, can there be a synthesis? And here the Rav gave a famous talk in 1956 to the YU Rabbinic alumni. Two talks the Rav gave, 55 and 56. Those talks are the most revealing that I know, where the Rav reveals his own inner soul, his own thinking. And there he deals with Yeshiva University. And he raises the issue that we have a thesis and an antithesis. The thesis is we have to be Yeshiva people, we have to learn, we have to be like Volozhin, we have to be like Brisk, we have to continue the tradition throughout the generations. The antithesis is, the antithesis is that we're in America, we're in Western culture, Western civilization. We can't be ghettoized. We have to have panasa. We have to have profession. And part of profession is, at one time you needed high school, college. Already by the 50s you needed graduate school. It conflicts. Can you find a synthesis? And there the Rav said, absolutely not. That a synthesis would be false. It would be trite. There you have to live with the thesis and the antithesis. And that's where the Rav developed the whole idea that I've quoted so many times, and I think I have it in my book as well, that we have to wear two hats. When we go to yeshiva, we're yeshiva people, and when we go to college, we're collegiate people. And that's why the Rav was opposed to a Catholic college. You see, it's very fascinating, very different than Rav Shimshon Ful Hirsch. What do I mean by a Catholic college? How many of you have gone to Notre Dame, know what a Catholic college, Fordham University? In a Catholic college, the secular curriculum is controlled. They will not allow a class where a teacher is going to get up and say, with the help of God, I will prove that there's no such concept as a Kaddish Baruch Hu. I'm quoting Professor Lippmann in YU, would get up in front of the class, with the help of God, I will now prove. And Catholic college, that could never happen. At least in my time. I don't know what's happened today. Today the Jews aren't Jews, the Catholics aren't Catholics. If Catholics eat meat on Friday, they're not Catholics anymore. So the whole world has changed. But think what I'm saying. A Catholic college, the curriculum was controlled. Take the Hirschian point of view. in the Hirschian high schools, and remember, Apfirish did not go beyond high school in Frankfurt. In the Hirschian high schools, secular subjects were taught either by religious Jews or by Goyim. You never wanted to expose the kid, the students, to non-religious Jews. Listen to what I'm telling you. Secular subjects were taught either by religious Jews or by Goyim. Think about it for a minute. In YU, there never was such a concept. The university was totally free. And the Rav, I remember we would go and complain periodically. There'd be big parades to the Rav complaining, for instance, about mythology, Greek mythology. It was on a high school level, but Greek mythology, I don't know what goes on today, but in my times, it was required for regions. Greek mythology was taught. Students would go, cry to the Rav. The Rav would look at them, you understand? He'd throw them out head first. To him, there was never a contradiction. When you're in yeshiva, in yeshiva. When you're in university, university. You wear two different hats. And you don't have a Catholic college. Halachically, it's a different question. How did the Rav justify it? I'll just tell you in parentheses. I think the Rav's approach is very simple. That once you have the ability to learn Shas and Poskim, if I can quote the Rama, Misham, Milei, Bitno, Basar V'Yayin, so once you have the Basar V'Yayin and that Shas and Poskim, so you won't have any, you'll be able to handle the contradictions, you'll know what the answers are. But in order to function in the Western world, you have to know what the Western world thinks. And it's interesting. There the Rav felt, it's not worth discussing because we're going to go way off. That's the Rav's feeling. If it works, it doesn't work, it's a different question. But the Rav felt that a synthesis was not possible. But nevertheless, he constantly went back to Kant. He constantly went back to what became his major preoccupation at the University of Berlin. Now, a final word on the thesis. I have never seen the entire thesis, but Shmati Machareha Pargod, I've heard behind the screen that there is a little bit talk today of the thesis being translated into English. I hear Panim Lakan Vapanim Lakan. Some people say since this thesis was written in the 1920s, late 20s, early 30s, it's outdated. There's been a lot more scholarship done on Kant, on Hermann Cohn, on the whole post-Kantanian era. Others say nothing is outdated in the sense that you have to see a thesis written in the context of when it was written. And since today, the majority of the world that would be interested in this would want to see it in English, it's worth translating into English. I don't know what's going to happen. Obviously, the thesis, the German must be on a level. If I had so much trouble dealing with Germans and dealing with Professor Israel Hildesheim and Dr. Israel Hildesheim and the title itself, how do you translate that into English? Allah at kama vakama, you can imagine what a job the translation will be of the original German thesis. Nevertheless, it probably would be a major moment in time, the Sirav Soloveitchik, in the 1929-1930, what he actually wrote and what his thesis has to say about Hermann Cohn. Now, he received his doctorate with honors. He marries, I don't know if I mentioned it last time, but of course, Tonya Levitt, the story with Tonya Levitt and her influence on the Rav is indescribable. She came from a similar background. She came from Vilna. She came to Western Europe to gain knowledge. The Rav Mitzah, according to the most reliable version I have of how the Rav Mitzah, I think I mentioned it to you, it's a result of his friend Genachovsky. People came to Genachovsky, offered him a shidduch. Genachovsky said, I have a roommate. They said, the girl has a roommate. And they went out on a double date, the Rav, Genachovsky, these two women, and they each married the woman they went out with. Now, Tanya gets her doctorate at the University of Jena, which is a suburb of Berlin. They have their first child in Europe, Atara, and they're ready to come to America. If you want to see the influence of Atara and marriage upon the Rav, I can only tell you the following. I thought I had seen all the greatness of Rebbe. I mean, Ribbono Shel Olam, you look at his hesped for Reb Chaim Heller, his hesped for the Brisker Rav. You look at the Shayurim Lezeicha B'Murray, most of which I heard either in person or via tape. You're overwhelmed by the man's mind. You look at Ish Halacha. A volume just appeared in America. 6 essays by the Rav entitled Family Redeemed. These were all talks that the Rav gave, some in the 50s, some in the 60s, one in the early 70s. They were worked on for manuscript. A beautiful job was done. Professor David Schatz and Dr. Joe Wolowowski. Beautiful job. The volumes should reach Israel shortly. Read the second essay on marriage. See what the Rav does there with marriage, with sex, with divorce, with children. He reaches philosophical heights that are indescribable. And you see, this is why a Talmud Chacham, a Gadol B'Yisrael, a philosopher, you can only reach these heights if you're a complete person. And see the insight that marriage gives the Rav into one of the most delicate areas of human relationship. It's overwhelming. You have to see to believe what the Rav does with marriage, with the relationship between the husband and wife. It's overwhelming. And this is Tanya. She complimented the Rav. The Rav was a genius. I'm going to talk about it on Thursday night in a different context when I give the lecture in memory of Rabbi Louis Bernstein. The Rav is a genius. A genius has a lot of difficulty relating to ordinary mortals. A genius tends to perfection. He finds it hard to put up with foibles of the average mortal. If a genius doesn't marry, he can never have any effect on the world. Because a wife, and you have to read the Rav's essays on marriage, Adam and Eve, marriage, a wife enables a genius. Somehow a woman, even if she herself is a genius, but a woman has been a yetera, the Gemara needed Daf Lamed Aleph, and she enables the genius to come down to the world. And I'll just tell you one story, skipping ahead, but it's an important story, and Jack says I haven't told the story in many years, so it's worth recording the story for posterity. I'm one of the few people alive that can tell this story because I'm an eyewitness. When I was in the yeshiva, we were very bright kids. I've said this more than once, and everyone agrees with me, including people who studied with the Rav before me and after me. There was never an era where the Rav had so many bright students as my years with the Rav. For Haraya, out of our class, outside of myself, Gedole Yisrael, originated people who are the greatest teachers of Torah in our generation. Right down the line, in America, in Israel, etc. And I've often wondered, why did you have this confluence? And I think there are two reasons why. Number one, we who were the American kids were very highly motivated. Most of us came from homes that were not totally religious. And again, we're not Bali Chiv, it's hard for you to understand this. We came from Jewish homes. But simply it was an era where your parents didn't know any better. That was an era where everyone worked on Shabbos. There were even Heterim quoted from Europe. Don't ask what was quoted. God have mercy. You worked 5.5 days a week. So we were very committed. Those of us that sought out Torah, b'chol libeinu, b'chol nafshenu, we were committed. And we were one element around the Rav. The other element was basically survivors. Kids who came to America running away from Hitler, either before Hitler, during Hitler, after Hitler. I don't have to tell you. These individuals who ran away from Europe, came to America, they had that ability, like an old classmate of mine came into the shiur yesterday, Oscar Krantz, that brought back so many memories. So he did high school in 2.5 years. You understand? These were bright kids. And all this coalesced around the Rav. Now, we went through the yeshiva. I went through all my rebbeim, Rav Michal Katz, Rav Yosef Weiss, Rav Bronstein, Rav Gerelich, Rav Volk. And we were like sophomores in college, and we were arrogant enough to feel that we wanted to learn with the Rav. I don't know how we did it when I look back. We petitioned the administration. And history was made. The Rav was going to say 2 shiurim in the yeshiva. 1 shiur he continues for the smicha boys in halacha. and one shiur a masechet for the college kids. And lo and behold, I thank God, was one of the agitators, and I find myself in the first shiur the Rebbe is giving to college kids. Now, it doesn't mean it was only college kids. Some of the older fellas came in too, because the Rebbe is saying a shiur in a masechet. So fellas like Barry Liebman, Aaron Batt, who were getting smicha, came to the masechet shiur as well. It was Sanhedrin. Now, I understand the Rav today. I didn't understand him then. We were frightened stiff of the Rav. He was young. He was intolerant. He was a genius. We were kids. But the Rav looked around the classroom. And he takes a look, 22, 25 young kids, just a little bit older than these pinheads running around BMT. Sometimes I look at these BMT kids. I say, I taught these kids for 20 years. I can't believe it. They look like they're 10 years old to me today. I taught them for 20 years, 69 through 89. So the Rav comes into the room. He looks around. He sees 22, 23 kids, look like a bunch of wise aleck pinheads. And the Rav probably figured, I better show these kids that this is serious business. That they're in the shiur. They're not here to play. They're here to learn. So what did the Rav do? First week goes by. It's an absolute true story, word by word. First week goes by. Second week goes by. Third week, the Rav comes back. Remember, Tuesday, Wednesday, then we didn't see the Rav again until next Tuesday. Rav comes back again Tuesday, and he says, I'll say it in English, how many boys understood last week's shiur? Raise your hands. How many boys didn't understand? And then he went down, you understood? And he would ask a question. Didn't like your answer, he wrote down shak run. Those who didn't understand at all, he wrote down lo yada. The few that answered him, he wrote yada. For a number of guys, he wrote down shak run. He said he knew, and he didn't know. We went into a panic. We met. I don't want to mention the names of the other fellas, the Yerubayim, the Gadol Yisrael today. I don't embarrass them. We met. We were frightened. Barry, we were biting our nails. We said, what's going to be with us? We're going to have ulcers before we're 21. I can remember saying it. We were on tea and Melba toast. So that night, or the next morning, Wednesday morning, we sent two guys. I was one of them. We went over to the Rebbe's apartment. We get the Rebbetzin. And we said, Rebbetzin, we're young kids. She said, just where we spoke to her. We're not going to survive. We told her what her husband did. This was Wednesday. It was Wednesday afternoon, right? They had to leave. I think the Rebbe had a wedding. We knew we could get the Rebbetzin alone. It was Wednesday. We told her the whole story. She said, let me, I'll take care of it. Threw us out, she'll take care of it. We were so frightened. Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, the Rebbe is back. It's like she would begin 12:30, quarter to one. He came to the airport, got to the yeshiva. We're sitting in the room. You could hear a pin drop. The Rebbe takes attendance. All our heads are down. Chas v'chalila, he should see, catch one eye. The tension is palatable. And everyone in his mind, what will the Rav say? What will the Rav say? And finishes attendance. And there you have a bunch of crybabies. Crybabies. Twice, I can still hear it in my ears. A bunch of crybabies. But he never wrote down Shakran again. And you see, that's a wife's task. That's a wife's job. He never wrote down Shakran again. He called us crybabies twice, but he probably got the devil from his wife. She probably said, Bera, what are you doing? They're young kids. They're serious. They wouldn't be in your class if they weren't serious. Make it a drop lower. Okay, good. Thanks. So, that's the wife. Okay, now let's pick up with America, coming to America. I spoke about the thesis. I began that way, Yitzchak. For your edification and everybody else's, there's no shiur next Monday. The big Reb Aaron has canceled out the little Aaron. David Miller has ruled, so you were correct. Excuse me? Sunday, I mean Monday Derishia. Excuse me, Taina Tester Derishia. Okay. Now, what's the Rebbe going to do? He's married, has a child. He was in Vilna for a while. He comes back to Berlin. What's he going to do? His father's in America. The world is shifting. He desperately wants to come to America. How do you come to America? And here the interview I quote on page 29 is critically important. At that time in the United States, you can only come in, remember, beginning with 1922, free immigration to America ends. It works with a quota system. The quota for East Europe is filled for the next 50 years or so. You need a non-quota immigrant visa. What does that mean? Those of you that have studied the constitutional law or studied American history, it means that you have to show that you are going to engage in a profession in America that you are uniquely needed for that profession. No one else can fill that niche. That's what it means, non-quota. Chicago at that time, Yeshiva in Chicago was an imitation of New York. It was organized by Saul Silber. In one of Rabbi Young's volumes, you have a biography of Saul Silber. You can read about it. My student David Gleischer, in an earlier issue of Tradition, going back maybe 10 years, I don't recall when it was, in the late 80s, early 90s, my dear student David Gleischer, who lives in Chicago and is married to the granddaughter of one of the founders of the Chicago Yeshiva, did a history of how Skokie began in Tradition. It was an imitation of Yeshiva and Yeshiva College. Now, Chicago is Chicago, it's not New York. And they were stumbling along looking for someone to put them on the map. YU, and what we're calling YU is, happens to be an anachronism. It was then Yeshiva and Yeshiva College, but popularly if I say YU, forgive me, it doesn't become YU till 45. What becomes YU had Reb Moshe. It wasn't big enough for two Soloveitchiks. The whole YU, as big as it was at that time, were the high school, the college, the smicha, a few hundred students. Skokie hears there's a chance to get a Soloveitchik. They issue the papers to bring the Rav to America. And the Rav is coming to America to become a Rosh Yeshiva. This is crucially important. This is his dream. This is his calling. And this is why he's leaving for America. He arrives in America. It's 1932. And this is the interview with Rabbi Oscar Fassman. Should live and be well. He's a man in his 90s today. He was an eyewitness to all this. One of the leading Chicago graduates. Later president of Skokie. What is today Skokie, the Hebrew Theological College of Chicago, turns to Reb Moshe and says, look, we enabled your son to come to America. We do not have money to pay his salary. There's no sense in his coming to Chicago. Find a position for him in the New York area. Now, look how Chazal are so right, HaKol Tolui B'Mazel. Just think for a minute what would have become of Chicago and what would have become of the Rav had he gone to Skokie in 1932. Because essentially, from a certain point of view, and I'll talk about this later today, Be'ezrat Hashem, or next week, from a certain point of view, the Rav wasted 10 years in Boston. 32 to 41, wasted, from a certain point of view. Imagine what have become. He would have gone to Chicago. Imagine the bright minds, what he would have attracted. No. They can't have him. Why you at that time, by the way, even if they wanted to have the Rav, they were starving. Rosh Yeshiva wouldn't pay. Reed, revel. Strikes, what went on. This I heard from eyewitnesses. Rav Moshe Playev told me, Rav Moshe Soloveitchik, very interesting. The yeshiva faculty never struck. Reb Moshe Soloveitchik asked their striking. Torah you have to teach whether you get paid or not. But Rav Palayev told me, what do you think, Reb Moshe Soloveitchik just asked it? Reb Moshe Soloveitchik also said, Dafab Nseichel, you have to be a little wise. If we don't teach, Rabbi Rebbe will find substitutes in a minute. They don't need such great names like Soloveitchik, like Palayev. They'll find, you know, younger people who just for the joy of teaching and don't have families yet, they'll teach the Gemara, the Rashi, the Tosfot, the Rambam. The students won't need the difference, won't know the difference. There's a lot of truth to that, you understand. Rabbi Rebbe used to complain, my problem is I have too many Rosh Yeshiva and not enough Melamdim. And by the way, even in YU today, without mentioning names, I've had students who let their hair down to me and said, Rebbe, I studied with this Rebbe, that Rebbe. I wasted my time. And they told me, the Rebbeim threw around knowledge and achronim and depth, and they needed a Rebbe to teach them how to learn Rashi, Tosfot, the Rambam, put it together, understand the Rishon, define the Rishon, understand the Machlokas, etc. They don't need such a great Rosh Yeshiva. So this is what Rabbi Halev told me. Rabbi Moshe said, what are we going to strike? They'll bring in senior students, recent graduates. They won't need us anymore. Now, I don't know if Rabbi Moshe said that, you know, seriously or sardonically, but it's a good vote. But anyway, there's no place for the Rav in YU at that time. Now, what was the American Orthodox rabbinate like? The 20s into the 30s was a time of great ferment in the American Orthodox rabbinate. Originally, in every community you had European immigrants who, for whatever the reasons are, didn't only stay in New York. They reached Philadelphia, they reached Boston, they reached Detroit, they reached Chicago, they reached smaller communities. And right up and down the line, these immigrants brought from Europe great rabbis. America was dotted with the most famous rabbinic names. Many of them were Lamdanim Mufakim. There was a Rabbi Zivitz in Pittsburgh, a Rabbi Leventhal in Philadelphia. The whole New York area was filled with Rabbanim. Louisville, Kentucky, Rabbi Nutlovich. They sent Rabbi Nutlovich that there wasn't a line in Tosfot in all of Shas he didn't know by heart. Trenton, all over New Jersey, Newark, there were great Rabbanim. Avkanovich in Newark. Phil Rav Kantorovitz in Trenton. Giants. Voloshina. But these rabbis were suffering. The new generation already spoke English. Yiddish was the second language. The new generation went to college. The conservative movement was making tremendous inroads. Rabbanim, in order to sustain themselves, in order to have panasa, got involved in kashrut. Kashrut, you have to remember, millions of Jews were still makbar on kashrut. At that time, even a conservative Jew kept the kosher home. It's not like today. So kashrut was a tremendous business. And these rabbanim were involved in kashrut. The minute you got involved in kashrut in America, there's no central focal authority. It's not like Britain, not like London, not like an organized rabbinate. And it was constant machloket, constant infighting, money at stake, panasar at stake. You're all familiar with this. As you see in my footnotes, I deal with this in Revel, I deal with it in Silva. Dr. Hal Gastwith did his entire doctorate on the machloket in kashrut in the New York areas, fraud, corruption, and holiness. Just dealing with the machloket in kashrut in the 20s and the 30s in the greater New York area. Generally speaking, outside of the big cities, and the big cities basically were New York and perhaps Baltimore, no Orthodox shul had its own rabbi. What would happen would be is a few shuls got together, they brought in a rav to the community, and everyone accepted this rav as the posek, He was called the chief rabbi, whatever that meant, of the community. He was in charge of kashrut in the community. He made his panasa through the kashrut. Generally speaking, the shuls properly chipped in, gave him a few dollars a week, but the rest of it came from weddings and funerals, and he was the rabbi of the community. This was his panasa, this was his calling, this is what he had to do. Perhaps he said shayurim, perhaps there was a chavrishas, but he was not limited to one shul. It was a number of shuls that gathered together that brought the rabbi into the community and supported the rabbi in a haphazard, desolatory fashion. It was a tragic time for these rabbis. Many of these rabbis never Americanized and literally got lost on the American scene. And I can explain why very easily. Listen to me very carefully. It's something you'll never forget. All other immigrants, or let's call them greenhorns to stress the point, all other greenhorns went to work. When you went to work willy-nilly, you had to Americanize. Whatever you did, whatever your profession was, you were a baker, you were a salesman, you owned a store, you were a butcher, you went to work. But you had to deal with people, you had to deal with clientele, you had to deal with language, you had to deal with concepts, you had to deal with money, you had to deal with middlemen, you had to deal with wholesalers. Somehow, you Americanized. You became part of the scene. The rabbi never left his study. What did he do? He dealt with shas and paiskim and shilas and funerals and weddings and kosher slaughter. But there was very little in the rabbi's life that enabled him to Americanize. And as the years moved on, the youth, the congregants, were in one world, and the elder rabbanim were in another world. And this remains an ongoing problem, and I can show it to you. I can illustrate it so beautifully. The greatest gaon that perhaps ever set foot in America was the rabbi of a conservative shul, conservative temple. Rabbi Yehuda Leib Foyer of Holyoke, Massachusetts. Rabbi Yehuda Leib Foyer was a gaon shebagayim. Was a Talmud Mufak of a Velazhen, a Talmud Mufak of Rav Chaim Brisker. When the Rav would meet Rav Yehuda Leib Foyer, the Rav would stand up with him for him. The Rav would embrace him. Rabbi Shlaim was a gaon adir. Rav Yehuda Leib Foyer's son-in-law, by the way, is Danny Trapper's uncle. There's a Trapper who's the son-in-law of Rav Yehuda Leib Foyer. I believe it's Danny Trapper's uncle, just to make it more meaningful for you. He was Rav of Holyoke. No, who was, what was Holyoke? Holyoke was a little community in Massachusetts where they always had an Orthodox shul. A lot of immigrants arrived there. By the late 20s, by the 30s, these immigrants were Americanized. Their kids already couldn't take the Orthodox shul. So they built a conservative temple. They went to Rabbi Foyer, whom they revered. They said, Rebbe, as long as you're alive, you're our rabbi. We will take no rabbi. And that was America. And in the conservative temple, Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, they used to get a student from the seminary who preached in English, but the rabbi, their rabbi, was Rabbi Foyer. He sold their chametz, he buried their dead, he performed their weddings. It was a transitional period. They revered him. He was a revered figure. But to daven week in and week out with him and not have a drasha in English and have men and women sitting separately, this they couldn't tolerate anymore. They were Americans. And this is just the typical story of the American Rabbinate. And you have to remember the conservative movement, just what I spoke about yesterday. Adam behefke nichalei. We Torah Jews have a difficult product to sell. Why? Because we're going against Western civilization. Western civilization says do whatever you want, however you want, whenever you want, wherever you want, as long as they don't harm anyone. They do harm, because what AIDS has done to the world, it's taken away billions of dollars that should go for cancer research and heart research, and it's going for AIDS. They do harm. Triage. There's not enough for everything. But all right, let's say they're not harming. That's the Western world. We're coming along. Shabbat, Kashrut, Tarat Mishpacha, the conservative movement. Nothing has changed. Conservative movement went to community after community. Don't listen to those old-fashioned rabbis. Don't listen to those outlandish rabbis. What do you need a machitza for? Men and women work together. Men and women go to school together. Why can't men and women worship together? It's no different than the ads on the Israeli radios at this moment of time. Who could believe when we have 27 Chavrei Knesset that are committed to Torah formally that ads run every hour? poking fun at mikveh on the at a time of Yitzchak Mordechai and Bill Clinton, and poking fun at mikveh when Ofra Chaza dies of AIDS. Are you on in this class? I just got to Avraham last name Lawrence. Right, we spoke about that last week. Avraham Yaakov. And you're known as Avraham Yaakov or Avi? Avraham Yaakov, you got it. Barry Goldfisher, Mordechai Kaplan. Where's Mordechai? There he is. Hanoch Davidman. There he is. Dov Hachbaum. Right on. Ari Kutla. Uh-oh. The NCSY has gotten to him and slaughtered him. Judah Dadek. Seth Kleinman. Wake him up. Wide awake. Seth Brownstein. Who is Seth Brownstein? Names appear. I don't got it. Matt Brenner. Jonathan Kaganoff. Eli Babish. There he is. Eli Blaustein. There he is. Reuven Boschnack. Reuven, you seem to be enjoying today's shiur. That smile has not left your face. Baruch Hashem. You make me happy. Zvi Engel. He's back in Galicia. Barry Silvergrab. Jacob Vidomlansky. I don't see him. And Avram Yaakov Lawrence. Okay, let me roll. You see, they appeal to the lowest element in the human being. A rabbi is telling you don't need a mechitza, you don't need tarat mishpacha. Adam behefkero nichala. You have to appreciate the terrible attack that Orthodoxy was under at every moment. The times were against it. The whole Western world was against it. The Americanization. In other words, religion belongs to old-landish, old-fashioned people. In Israel, we're living it today. Today in Israel, your mamish living the early 30s is repeating itself right here with the average Israeli who knows absolutely nothing. And imagine, he hears on the radio, forget about mikveh, what do you need a mikveh slip? You know, the pit, and they use the words, they know how to poke fun at the rabbinate and think for a moment where we're living, what we're living, how we're living, and this is what they're finding fault with. Now, Hakol Tolui B'Mazel. Boston, believe me, Kolzman the Rebbe was in Europe, Kolzman the Rebbe was on the boat coming to America, he never heard about Boston. But what happened was, in Boston, and there was a large immigrant community there, because Boston is an important center, an important city, there were rabbanim there. There was tremendous machloket over kashrut. And one of the big rabbanim, Rabbi Krieger, I believe it's Rabbi Avram Abba Krieger. You can check it out in Toldot Anshei Shem. But I believe the name is Rabbi Avram Abba Krieger. I believe he has a son living in Yerushalayim, the heart of Yerushalayim. No youngster today. In the middle of the machlokes, Rabbi Krieger died of a heart attack. And that opened up a focal rabbinic position in Boston. At that moment in Boston, there was the Vat HaIr. Later, it became the Vat HaIr, Chafashas. Explain to me what had happened here. Originally, it was the Vat HaIr. And that unified, I want to say, all the Orthodox congregations, because it's impossible for Orthodox Jews to be totally unified, but it unified most of the Orthodox congregations in Boston. They heard that the Rav arrived in America, they invited the Rav to Boston, and there was an Alta Abelo there, one of the Balabatim, who I'm told was an old Slabatka Talmud Chacham, Paki and Shas, great Talmud Chacham, a businessman. He took the lead, and they invited the Rav to become their rabbi in Boston. Now, what was involved? Exactly what I told you. He would be the Rav of a number of Orthodox synagogues. He could daven and circulate between them. His panasa was giving a shiur, taking over the kashrut. The Rav of this Vat Ha'ir, popularly called the chief rabbi of Boston, but that's a meaningless title. And the Rav goes up to Boston. And here the Rav, and I quote the Rav's own words, I was a newcomer. I was new to America. I was in a new situation. I had to Americanize. I had to learn a great deal. And the Rav now was exposed to the world of the Agudat HaRabbanim, the world of the Orthodox Rabbinate of America. And with the Rav's coming to Boston and the Rav starting to function in Boston, the Rav becomes caught up in the American Rabbinate with one dream: to become a leading American Rav, a leading American rabbi. Now, a few words of background. Barry, what are we talking about the American Rabbinate? I saw today last week, the YU office sent a list of positions available, endless pages. I read it, I looked at it. The rabbinate that faces you today has very little in common with what we're talking about in the early 30s. We're talking about, as I described a few minutes ago, an East European world that's fading as their children become Americanized. Their parents still can only relate to a rabbi of the old country. The children have their inheritance for a rabbi of the old country, but they are seeking rabbis of the new country. At this moment in time, the Union of Orthodox Rabbis of the United States and Canada is the only Orthodox Rabbinical Association in America. What we call the Agudas HaRabbanim was not only the powerful one, it was the only one. And it united all the East European rabbis throughout the United States. I don't believe there was one member of the Agudas HaRabbanim who was not born in Eastern Europe, who was not an immigrant to the United States. It was at the high point of its zenith of its career. Hundreds of rabbanim all over the United States, strictly Orthodox congregations, most of them involved in kashrut, many of them lamdanim of hakim, all of them with bona fide smichot from the leading European yeshiva and Rosh Yeshiva and rabbanim, and this was the Agudas HaRabbanim. There was no RCA and there was no Hasidic rabbinic organization. Agudat HaRabbanim was it. It was the only player in town. Who becomes the Rav's confidant and role model? How do I know that the Rav wanted to become an American rabbi? How do I know that his dreams have shifted? How do I know that he's waking up to a new reality? Because the Rav becomes extremely close to Rav Lazer Silva. And this man, at this moment in the Rav's life, becomes the most dominant role model for the Rav, what the American rabbinate is all about, and what the American rabbinate can become. And the Rav starts a relationship with Rav Lazer Silva that will go on to the day that Rav Lazer Silva dies. If you want to know how strong this relationship is, I can tell you one little story. Long after the Rav has left the rabbinate, and long after these dreams are over, and long after the Rav is in a different world with different aspirations, his daughter is marrying Rav Aaron Lichtenstein. Tova is marrying Rav Aaron Lichtenstein. And Gedolei Gedolei Yisrael are at the wedding. Rav Moshe Feinstein, Rav Shmuel Belkin, many others. Do you know who the Rav is Mechabed L'Sadei Kedushin? Rav Lazer Silva. It tells you something. It says something. Rav Lazer Silva was a very unique story on the American scene. Rav Lazer came from Europe the early 1900s and went into a small rabbinate in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. They say about Rav Lazer Silva, he became a gadol in Harrisburg. Very fascinating. He came at a very young age. He was in his 20s. And he became a gadol in Harrisburg. He remained there something like 17 years. You can check the Silva era. It was a small community. Harrisburg remains a small community until today. And outside of his rabbinical functions, he learned around the clock. From there, he went out to Springfield, Massachusetts. From there to Cincinnati. And he became a world personality. As I've said many times, there was no other American Rav who was not a Rosh Yeshiva, who became a world personality like Reb Lazer Silva. He put Agudat HaRabbanim on the map. And for decades, he was the president, the member of the Presidium, Reb Lazer. Now, what did the Rav think of Reb Lazer Silva? And here I quote to you, you have it in my book, you have it in the Hesped for Reb Lazer Silva, 1968. But let me tell it to you through the mouth of Reb Lazer Silva's grandson. Reb Lazer Silva was zeichet to have many grandchildren who were Shomrei Torah Mitzvot. Among them, one grandson, a big Talmud Chacham, a Rosh Yeshiva in Kerem Biafna, Reb Baron Silva, married to my Talmidah, Shoshana Freudenstein, who lives in Hanov. If you know Reb Baron Silva, he was laid back, a quiet boy, wonderful mind, son of Rabbi David Silva, and he comes into the Rav Shia. And by now, he comes into the Rav Shia, it's the late 60s, 70s, whatever it is. And by now, the Rav has in the Shia, not like in my time, 25, 30 students. There are 120 people sitting there. It's a yeshiva unto itself. A shamus takes attendance. And David Silva sitting in front of, Aaron Silva sitting in front of the Rav, a year and a half. I heard the story from Aaron Silva. Heard it from others, but heard from him directly. And like a year and a half into the Shia, someone probably said to the Rav, you know, Rabbi Soloveitchik, you have Reb Lazer Silva's grandson in your class. The Rav said, what? What are you talking about? You have an Aaron Silva. The Rav comes into class the next time and he says to Aaron Silva, tell me, you are Reb Lazer's grandson? He says, yes. Why didn't you tell me? Aaron said, no need to tell you. So the Rav said, I'm going to tell you a story about your grandfather. And this is the story that says it all. The Rav has just arrived in America. It's 1932. I heard, by the way, so many eyewitnesses. Only one is still alive that I know of. Reb Melech Shechter can tell you this. So the Rav came. The students at Yeshiva were cynical, sarcastic. Reb Moshe used to boast, my son Dagon, my son Dagon, my son Dagon. You know the way students are, son Dagon. Yeah, you can imagine, you know. Reb Moshe is boasting about his son. Cut it out. And then they announced, the Rav is going to give his first year in the yeshiva, a guest lecture in honor of his father in the Beis Medrash, in something in Zvachim. Chesugyan Zvachim, if I'm not mistaken. And it fills up with all the cynical yeshiva boys, and the Rav comes in, you know, if you recall what he looked like, as Rakefet has proven, he was well over 6 foot, clean shaven, and these guys figure he's a basketball player, what kind of shan? He gives his shir, they fell off their feet, they couldn't believe what they heard. A week later, he's going to give his shin out, the Gudas HaRabbanim. It's a Sersni Mei Tshuva, giving a Tshuva Drasha in honor of his father to say hello, to meet Reb Moshe's son. So the Rav said, my father called me aside, my father told me, and this is in the book. Father told me, I heard this from Aaron Silva, but it's also the husband. Father told me, Hetzu Beryl, listen to me, mein Zun Beryl, my son Beryl. You're going to come into the room of the Agudas HaRabbanim. I don't have it all in the book. Some of it is not that complimentary. You're going to come into the room of the Agudas HaRabbanim. You're going to see a room filled with Shayna Rabbanim. Nice looking rabbis, all in black beard. You know, they all looked the role, played the role, dressed the role. He says, don't be overwhelmed by the way they look. Almost none of them have learned. They all have good memories. All they know is what they learned in Europe. They haven't learned the word in America. But there's just one guy there you should watch out for. You're going to see a short little guy with a big cylinder, a great cylinder. He's the one guy, Reb Moshe tells his son, he knows every word, not only of Yoyimba, he knows every word of the Tosfos Shoshanim by heart on Yoyimba. For em daf min hoben, daf min zichitin. You got to watch out for. And then the Rav describes, you know, he walked in. You can imagine the tension. He's a young kid. The Rav is a young kid. Don't you understand? Don't think of the Rav as I call him the Rav. Then he was Reb Yosef Dive, the son of Reb Hagoyin Reb Moshe. And the Rav Taka walked into the room, and it's filled with all these guys in long black coats and long beards and some minzitz. And the Rav Taka sees one little guy in the corner with a tzalinda. And I'm quoting Rebbe now. Rebbe says, the Rav says, the whole shiur, he was writing things, He says, and then after this year he walked over, gave me Ayasha Koyach, gave me his tzettel, the little note with all the questions, and the Rav said there were like 6-7 fabulous questions that your grandfather asked that I saw he was on London Shebalam Dunham. The Rav said in his hesped with a sense of humor, he said, thank God he didn't stop me in the middle of the shir with these questions, or he would have shut down the shir altogether. Understand? That was Rav Lezer Silva. Who installed the Rav as the rabbi spiritual leader, Hanukkah time 1932 in Boston? Rav Lezer Silva. Who constantly visited the Rav? Because Rav Lezer Silva was constantly traveling, constantly on the go. They used to say a joke about Rav Lezer Silva. He'd go to the train station, get on a train, and he'd ask the conductor, where are you going? Fine, I have business in that city. Wherever the train was going, he had Rabbanim, he had business, he was involved, I got it Rabbanim. This was Rav Lezer Silva. This was the Rav. This was his dream. What affected the dream? What influenced the dream? What harmed the dream? What killed the dream? And here you come to a sad story. A story that influences and shapes and colors the Rav's entire gestalt to the day of his death. And I'll give you information that I'm recording for the year 2050 that you'll only hear in this classroom, and you'll hear something that will tie it all together. As the Rav gets involved in Boston, and you have to understand that this history repeats itself, an Orthodox Jew can do everything on his own. You can daven on your own. You can learn on your own. You can observe Shabbos on your own. You can go to mikvah on your own. The one thing you can't do on your own in modern times is prepare your food. We live in a world where it's not Robinson Crusoe. We don't wake up in the morning and harvest the grain and do everything involved to make the bread. Alach at kama v'kama when it comes to chickens and meat. So inevitably, willy-nilly, whether a Rav likes it or not, he is drawn into kashrut. He has to be drawn into kashrut. Because without kashrut, you can't eat. And without kashrut, you can't be a Rav. Without kashrut, you can't have a community. This is what destroyed Rabbi Jacob Joseph. When RJJ came to America, Ribbono Shel Olam, had he gotten involved in chinuch, all of America would have been different. But he couldn't get involved in chinuch before he straightened out kashrut. You can't bring over Rashi Yeshiva before he has something to give them to eat. And the Rav saw what was going on in Boston. And he was drawn into the kashrut problems. And he tried to supervise. And he tried to improve. But not only halachically, there was another problem involved that comes up time and again on the American scene. I write about it in great detail in the Silver Era. In America, everyone was unionized. Sheikhtim were not yet unionized. And the capitalists took full advantage of them. Now, if a person, remember, when were chickens bought? Thursday, Friday. If a sheikh starts working Thursday morning and works through all of Thursday night, by midnight his shechita will be worthless. It's just impossible. The capitalist or the owners of the Schlachthäuser couldn't care less. They wanted more chickens. They wanted more meat. Conditions were terrible, particularly for the dakot, particularly for the poultry shochets. Shochtim. And the Rav tried to organize, the Rav tried to be standards, the Rav tried to make union, etc., etc. All the details are in the book. Obviously, the owners of the slaughterhouses were upset with the Rav. Organizing the sheikhdom means higher wages, higher salaries, less profit, etc. But you have to find a catalyst. What are you going to make the machloket over? to other rabbis. They were offended. Who was the Rav? And see, this constantly undermines us on the American scene. This is what undermined Don J.J. He set up proper hashkacha, proper standards. Within a week, there were two other rival basedins declaring his shchita treif and only their shchita kasher. The same thing happened in Boston. And then when they saw they couldn't undermine the Rav, that the shochtim are with the Rav, they started spreading rumors that money is passing hands, illegal income, not being declared for tax purposes, the Rav is becoming a millionaire, and it became a full-blown scandal. And I'll talk about the scandal in one moment. Now, one of the key figures in the group that was against the Rav, opposed to the Rav, was Rabbi Mordechai Savitsky. And a number of people criticized me why I didn't explain it in the book, why didn't I mention his name. And the truth is, I did leave it out. I left it out on purpose because Rabbi Savitsky just died a year or two ago. Their children, their grandchildren, leave it for the year 2050 to be analyzed properly. But I want to give you a little insight because I finally was able to uncover why Rabbi Savitsky, what the machleket, something that added a new light on this whole machleket, and I want to record it for posterity. First of all, who is Rabbi Mordechai Savitsky? This itself is important. You're dealing here with a great Talmud Chacham. He was known as the Ilui from Lida, where he was born, studied with the Chafetz Chaim, married into the Chafetz Chaim's family. He was married to the daughter of the Valesha Rav, Rav Pupko. Rav Lezer Pupko himself was a nephew of the Chafetz Chaim. So he married into the Chafetz Chaim's family, 1938. Comes to America, winds up in Boston. Rav Mordechai Savitsky was a gon adir. Now, there were a number of such people that reached America, goinim shebegoinim. They wound up in America, as I've said time and again, total failures because they didn't go into chinuch. The ones that succeeded in America were the gedolim who went into chinuch, succeeded as Rashi Yeshiva, had Talmudim, remained in learning, and they became Rabbi Moshe Feinstein's, Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky's. People like Rabbi Mordechai Savitsky and his ilk, Rabbi Simcha Elberg, Rabbi Chaim Zimmerman, who simply couldn't teach, couldn't relate, Rabbi Chaim Kriswith, to a lesser degree, also taught, didn't succeed. These people became wasted on the American scene. Rabbi Mordechai Savitsky, this great Eli, comes to Boston. Now, here's the point that I never understood. And I record this. In a December 24th, 1994 interview with Joseph Abelo, Joey Abelo is the son of Rabbi Alta Abelo, who brought the Rav to Boston. Joey explained to me exactly what happened. Abelo himself studied in Rotten with the Chafetz Chaim, his father. Reb Mordechai Savitsky not only studied in Rotten with the Chafetz Chaim and the Chafetz Chaim's yeshiva, but he was a son-in-law of the Chafetz Chaim's nephew. He was married into the family. And his mother-in-law, the Valesha Rebbetzin, La Briut, came to see Joey's father, Reb Alta Abelo, and Joey told me, he was an eyewitness to this, she yelled at the father, yelled at Reb Alta Abelo, I quote, "You studied in Radin, why don't you help the family of the Chafetz Chaim? Why do you support Rav Soloveitchik and you don't support giving my son-in-law the kashrut in Boston?" That's a very fascinating point because it shows you already that evidently Reb Mordechai Savitsky felt that since he was from Radin and part of the family, and Alta Abeloch had studied in Radin, maybe, in the back of his mind, he came to Boston in the hopes he would be able to take over the kashrut, that he would have that panasa, he would have that income. It's all in the family, Radin. And Reb Alta Abeloch remained totally loyal to the Rav and refused to allow anyone else to come in. And then, of course, the machloket took off the ground. Once person, whatever his reasons were, I'm from Radin, belongs to me. The owners were malcontented. They were angry at the Rav. Perhaps there were others that had a score to settle. And this kashrut scandal became a major issue by the early 40s. The investigation went on for over 2 years. The state attorney general, I have the name, I have all the facts in the book, could not ignore it. They had to call in a retired judge. They found the judge who was Jewish, not observant, but Jewish. Abraham K. Cohn, everyone called him A.K. Cohn. And he was put in charge by the state attorney general of Massachusetts of investigating this scandal and where the truth is. I heard from the Rav's family that the Rav suffered immeasurably. And Tova told me she was old enough to remember, of course. I don't want to give her year of birth. She's a woman, but she's older than I am. So by the early 40s, she has a recollection. And Tova told me she remembers her father coming home, and what bothered him the most? That people could appear before the commission and lie, tell lies with a straight face. And I have to tell you, we were in the yeshiva world. We were all our life have been nurtured and raised on truth and sincerity and honesty. It's shocking. It's shocking. At the end of the investigation, not only was the Rav completely exonerated, but A.K. Cohn became a devotee of the Rav, an admirer, overwhelmed by the purity of the man, the statements that A.K. Cohn made. Read about it. Now, with all the exoneration, this event had a lasting impact on the Rav's life in two major areas. Area number one, the Rav was finally convinced the rabbinate was not for him. Being a Reb Lezer Silva was not for him. Conquering the Agudas HaRabbanim and becoming a president and following the role model of Reb Lezer Silva was not for him. All the dreams that gradually built up in the Rav in 32 and 33 and 34 were completely demolished by 41 and 42 and 43. But there was a more far-reaching result. From this time on, the Rav constantly fled from controversy. He was frightened by controversy. The fight over the kashrut, with all the innuendos, with all the lashon hara, with all the rechilut, with all the public gossip, with all the heartache, it left tremendous scars on the Rav. I heard this from his daughter. I heard this from Menachem Ganak, who knew the Rav intimately. I later heard it from the Rav himself on tape in a hesped for Reverend Goldman, who was one of the sheikhtim who the Rav said stood shoulder to shoulder with me. I quoted in a footnote in this controversy. It just demolished the Rav. And this will explain to you, and I never understood this. I learned in Lakewood. In Lakewood at that time, I don't know today, they spent a lot of time criticizing YU and the Rav Lubavitch and the Lubavitch Rebbe. They had a positive message, but 40% of the time was negative. Maybe they had to be negative in order to break down the other barriers and get the person to remain in Lakewood. I don't know. Chinuch-wise, when I look back, it's not a healthy way to be machaneich. But one of the tremendous criticisms they had about the Rav was he never took public stands. And I have to tell you, in the Torah world, every Monday and Thursday, there are issues that come up, and the Rav never took public stands. And they were critical. And as a kid, I listened, gee, Reb Aaron Cutler is speaking out, the Satmar Rebbe is speaking out, the Lubavitcher Rebbe is speaking out, Rav Yitzchak Kuttner is speaking out, the Rav doesn't speak out. I never understood it. Later in life, I understood the Rav. He never took a public stand unless he felt it was absolutely necessary. Machloket achieves nothing. And that's that beautiful letter I have from the Rav, which I believe I showed you a while back, where I asked the Rav a question about getting involved in Machloket, and the Rav wrote to me, Al Yitrarev, don't get involved, don't make a public issue out of it. Afilu L'Shem Shemayim. And people don't realize that the Rav was not Art Scroll. He was a human being. And to have gone through what he went through in Boston with the kashrut, with the testimony, with all this heartache, you can see the scars that left on his personality. And in retrospect, I understand something else. I didn't really appreciate at the time. In my first rabbinate, I got killed. You all know that. Literally killed. I look back now. I was a kid of 23. Slaughtered. I was there 2 weeks, 3 weeks. They send a letter to Mr. Victor Geller, who placed me there. Get this moron Rothkopf out of here. Two, 3 weeks later, I have a copy of the letter in my possession until today. And a kid, you're 23 years old. How do you handle it? And I remember I went crying to Rebbe, and I wrote, I remember Rebbe kept on comforting me. And I could see. And now I realize in retrospect, it was more than just sympathy. It was empathy. Because who knew what it was for a rabbi in the field to go through all the aggravation, get involved in machloket, and balabatim pro and con, and it's like a snowball. Once machloket begins, you never know what's going to happen, and everyone gets involved, and we're throwing snowballs, and the snowball keeps on rolling, and it gets worse, and the aggravation, and the chilul Hashem, and the fighting. Everybody shalaylam. I now understand in retrospect, and I look at the letters from Rebbe, and I understand that it was more than sympathy. It was empathy. And I remember talking with Rebbe, I'd gone to YU to speak with Rebbe, and Rebbe says to me, I want to tell you something over from Reb Chaim. He said over from Reb Chaim, it's a famous part. He said, Reb Chaim hat gesagt, a Rav, was me wilt nicht treiben, a Reus vom Stadt, es a Simen es nicht a Rav. And a Rav, was lach sich a Reus treiben, es a Simen es nicht a Mensch. Translated, a rabbi whom they don't want to chase out of the city, it's a sign he's not a good rabbi. And if the rabbi lets himself be chased out of the city, it's a sign he's not a man. So I want to record for posterity that in my own case, I was re-elected. What was the vote? 9-8, 10-9, you read the article, right? How was I re-elected? By one vote, but I was re-elected by the board of directors. And lahavdil, between a little nobody and my rebbe, the Rav was totally exonerated. But nevertheless, the scandal left very deep scars upon him. Now, let me end off the class just on this vein. However, what is interesting, and I have to do justice to Rebbe, when he felt the issue was of prime importance and our backs were against the wall and there was no ifs, ands, or buts, then Rebbe came out and made the strongest stands possible. And I can give you three classic examples that affect the Torah world until this very minute. Number one, the Machitza. Never forget it. You fellas today, I looked at all those descriptions. I didn't see one shul that said it doesn't have a Machitza. You don't know how fortunate you are. When we were your age and we were offered a rabbinate, the first question was, do you want a machitza shul or you'd be willing to take one with mixed seating? Mixed seating was all over the place. If you found a shul without a machitza, with separate seating, you were happy. I was called the masochist by Rabbi Louis Levitsky, the Reconstructionist rabbi, because he offered me a shtela with mixed seating. He once heard me speak at a funeral in the early 60s, and I told him I can't take it. It doesn't have mechitzah. He called me a masochist. Louis Levitsky studied in the yeshiva on East Broadway. You don't know how fortunate you are. The 50s, it was vanished. When the Mount Clemens case came up and Baruch Litwin appealed to the Michigan Supreme Court and made the case on a public trust that so much money has been given over the years for an Orthodox synagogue by definition has to have mechitza, Rebbe gave expert testimony, wrote and published, spoke out loud and clear that a shul without separate seating forfeits its sanctity and you cannot be yotzei tefillah. And that was Rebbe's famous answer, which was published, republished, cited. He was criticized, maledicted, stood his ground. His brother-in-law had moved to a suburb. There was no Orthodox shul. All you had was a temple. And could he go to the temple to hear shofar on Rosh Hashanah? And the Baal Tokeya said he will refuse to come and blow for him privately. And that was Rebbe's famous answer. Stay at home, daven, don't hit tkiyat shofar, be mavatala mitzvah tasei, but you cannot be yotzei in a shul with this mixeding. And you have no idea how that psak reverberated. Number two, guess who's coming to town in a week or two, whenever it is? The Pope. Pope is coming. You don't understand what ecumenism is. Suddenly they came up with the idea, we're going to talk to the Jews, we're going to be nice to the Jews. What it meant was very simple. For thousands of years we killed Jews and most of them didn't convert. Now let's smile at them. Have theological discussions. Let's see where it will lead to. And there were Orthodox Jews at that time, so-called. Today they're Yitz Greenberg. I don't know if I can call them Orthodox anymore. But they were in favor. Let's discuss. The Pope is willing. Theological interaction. What do you say? What's not nice? If if Rabbi Yitz Greenberg is an Orthodox Jew, all I can tell you is I read his talk at the University of Denver 1980 that the Holocaust released us from the covenant. I can quote it word by word. If that's orthodoxy, you got a long way to go, or you got to prove the manuscript is forged and he didn't say it. But he made a mistake. You and Saul Berman with Rabbi Rackman's mistakes. You're very liberal with other people's mistakes. I don't want to make a mistake and I will stand on what I'm saying. So people were in favor of a talk with the Catholic Church. The Rav came out loud and clear. And he published. You don't know what it meant for the Rav to publish at that time. He was still a perfectionist. He still hadn't mellowed. And he published Confrontation in Tradition, where he stated clearly, on a theological level, we have nothing to discuss with the Catholic Church. We cannot discuss because each theological position is totally different. There's nothing that overlaps. And what can we discuss? We're committed to our own system of theological belief. Social, other issues, general issues perhaps, but not theological. And the Rav was very strong. And his statement changed the course of history. Because until that moment there was a debate. The minute the Rav spoke, by the 1960s he was the Rav. The minute he spoke, it changed the issue. The third issue, of course, is Rabbi Rackman, is the Hafkat Kedushin. Which 1975, it's hard for me to believe, it's already 25 years ago. But Rabbi Rackman spoke at RCA and presented what today became operative, Hafkat Kedushin. And 2 weeks later, the Rav spoke at YU Rabbinic Alumni and he related to Rabbi Rackman's proposal in a very strident stand and took Rabbi Rackman to task and we're cutting off the very branches of the tree on which we sit. What do we know that the Chatam Sofer didn't know, that the Noda Yehuda didn't know? And it was a classic statement of Torah and surrender to Halacha. That's where he told the story about Rochester. The girl who became religious, Catholic girl, did a paper on Judaism in high school, started studying Judaism, converts to Judaism, becomes Orthodox, and in graduate school meets a Jewish boy, and they get engaged, and the Jewish boy has now become frum through the girl's influence, and he goes to the cemetery to look at his roots, and he sees the tombstone with the split fingers, goes to his rabbi, takes a picture of it, what is this? And the rabbi tells him, you're a Kohen, your father's father's a Kohen, you're a Kohen, you cannot marry a Giyoret. And that's the story the Rav told, and that story reverberated. How the couple comes to the Rav, and the Rav says, with all the pain in my heart, there's nothing I can do. This is the halacha. We must surrender to the Baha Hashem. And as the Rav says, the woman walked away from the boy that she created. She made him from. She brought him to Judaism. And she walked away and started all over. And that was a very famous talk, quoted and requoted. But that was a public stand. Three tremendous public stands on three public issues. Some might want to say, give me one more second. Some might want to say in the early 80s with the women's issue, the Rav also got involved. However, I have to tell you, with the women's issue, the Rav already, his health was failing. And I cannot say that he took a striking public stand. He was caught up in the turmoil, and I best, someone spoke to me before class yesterday, but I listened on my way to teach yesterday afternoon. I was listening to a tape of the Orthodox Forum. So Rabbi Aaron Adler was speaking. Rabbi Aaron Adler is a Talmud of the Rav out of the 70s. So Aaron Adler related the following story. Now, again, when someone relates a story, you have to know, can you believe it? I would say that Aaron Adler can be believed at face value on the story. There's no political agenda. And Aaron Adler related the following story, that the Rav was asked by Aaron Adler, Rebbe, women want to make a mezumen. You know, Meika Hadin, women, Zimun. So what should I paskin for them? And the Rav said to him, I'll tell you what to do. If you feel that it's from Yirat Shemayim they're asking, tell them they're allowed to do it. If they're asking for feminist reasons, tell them they're allowed to do it. That was the Rav's answer. But you see, that answer, you can't exactly say is a public stand. And that gets us involved in Rav Heschel Shechter with the Yisa on the women's prayer groups, and the Rav refused to sign the Yisa. Why didn't he sign the Yisa? And so much has been written to Pulim on top of Pulim, although I'm convinced that Kenny Brander is absolutely accurate. He was the Rav's Gabbai and Shamus and confident at the time, and that the Rav simply didn't sign the Yisa because he felt it was a political statement, not a halachic statement. Halachically, you cannot ask a woman going into a room and 100 women davening together. As long as they don't say Kedusha, the Ram Shepherd Kedusha, how can you ask her it? But politically, the Rav felt he was opposed. However, when the statement came out in halachic opposition, the Rav felt he couldn't sign. And Kenny Brander told me, the Rav told him, you have to tell anyone who asks you that that's why I refuse to sign. It is not a halachic prohibition, but it is a political statement, and it should have been rephrased and stated properly. So I don't think that you can quote the Rav as taking a public stand on women's issues in the 1980s as part of the trilogy, which I quoted a minute ago. Yitzchak, yes. Yeah, go ahead. Yeah, we'll come to that. Yeah, we'll come to that. No, but say that. Those weren't so much public statements as much as the one with the chaplaincy was never a public statement. That was just within the YU community. The one with the with mixed board of rabbis is a major issue, but there's not so much as a public statement as a lack of a public statement. But we'll come to that. That deals already with RCA and a different world. Yeah, of course, absolutely. Not only permitted, I spoke with him on that very topic. I spoke in learning and didn't the Malchut at dinner with going into the draft, the army. I have it in Rakhafar Aaron in the tradition article. The Rav approved every word I wrote. He liked it, as a matter of fact, if I may be brazen enough to use those words. Yes, are there any more questions? Gentlemen, to reiterate, what did we do today? What did we do? It's unbelievable. You see, the Rav's winding up in Boston, that Yitzchak Rubin can speak about the Rav as a personal friend, and that he has a letter in English from the Rav. I have no letter, all my letters from the Rav are in Hebrew, but I corresponded in Hebrew. You have a letter in English. That Yitzchak Rubin can talk about the Rav as his personal friend is only a hakol talui b'masal. It's only because in 1932 there was a depression, Chicago was broke, they wrote to Reb Moshe, find a place for your son in the New York area. And they found Boston. That was the shul. That was the area. That was Reb Alta Abelow, who's buried right next to the Rebbe. If you have to, it's amazing. The Rebbe and his wife, and right over is Reb Alta and his wife. And Reb Alta Abelow brought the Rebbe to Boston. The Rebbe wanted to conquer the world. He was young. He had a dream. Reb Eliezer Silva. It's an amazing thing. That was the Rebbe's model. That was the Rebbe. That was the Rebbe's. That was the Rebbe's role model. The Rebbe wanted to be like Reb Eliezer Silva. He inaugurated the Rebbe. He was friendly with the Rebbe. The kashrut, everything that went on. But the Rebbe was drawn in. And this is what I said. They were wasted years because the Rebbe didn't develop intellectually. We're going to come to this next week. He's in Boston, the rabbinate, the kashrut, the fights, the infighting, what's going on. But that infighting had tremendous impact on the Rebbe's subsequent life. Don't forget what I told you about Rav Mordechai Savitzky with the rotten connection. Yitzchak, did you know that, the rotten connection? No. I don't want to tell that. Leave that out now. That's too early even to put on a tape. Oh, God, it's got it. Don't put me in jail yet. His family. But that's an amazing story. The rotten connection, it now helps you understand what the machloket was about. You understand these people were fighting for Panasa, and this was the turf, and there was limited turf. But that machloket left an impact on the Rav.